Good evening. Welcome to tonight's On the Edge with me, Theo Chalmers. Tonight's show is once again 2 hours long and live. So if you have any questions for our guests during the show, text them to 8778 with the word edge, a space, and then your name, location, and your message. And we'll try to pick up on any that really hit the mark. They're all charged at standard rate, so why not get texting? A question. Do you remember where you were on the morning of Sunday, 1st of September, 1997? No? What if I mention the Place d'Alma underpass? Dodi Fayed, Henri Paul, and Trevor Rees-Jones. Got it now? Good. Well, in tonight's show, I'll be talking with a very special guest, an investigative journalist and co-author of a controversial book on the death of Princess Diana on that summer night in Paris in 1997. It's called Princess Diana, The Evidence. My guest is John King. What a show we've got tonight. John, welcome.
Hi.
I'm going to show the camera your book before we start. This is John's book. If you can zoom in on that a bit. Look at that. And I'm not moving it around tonight. So, John, how on earth did you get involved in writing this book?
Well, yeah, it's quite a story, really. There are two... First of all, a bit about my background. I happened to grow up in Sandhurst on the Surrey-Berkshire border, where the RMA, the Royal Military Academy, mm-hmm. is where Princes William and Harry recently trained. But all around there, I mean, there's Aldershot is just down the road. It's known as the home of the British Army. And for about a 30, 40-mile radius all around that area, it's pretty much all military... Or top secret research and development facilities, etc., MOD compounds. And there's also a kind of an unofficial private security firm that worked out of Sandhurst a lot in the 70s and 80s, particularly as I was growing up there. And these guys were basically hired by MI6 to go out to places like Angola, interestingly, and this is what it's leading to, really, where Diana's landmines campaign was focused. So just by coincidence, I just happened to know these guys, or I knew their families. The Sanders was a very small little village in those days. I either knew them or I knew their brothers or went to school with their brothers. And a lot of what they did, although... you would think it was probably quite, you know, secret or top secret missions they were going on. You know, it was a small town mentality in Sandhurst, and a lot of things were spoken about. So
even though it was supposed to be secret what they were doing, they would talk to their friends, and presumably if you were one of their friends, they would talk to you a little bit.
And when I got old enough to, you know, go to the pub and things, you'd be surprised the things that were spoken about quite openly, actually. So, anyway, the point being that I happen to know these guys. I happen to know a lot about, through knowing them, what actually was going on in Angola and what was really going on behind the scenes there. So I knew all these guys who were either former SAS guys or some other elite force, special forces personnel, or attached to some or other security or intelligence unit and hired by MI6 to do the British government's dirty work, basically. So that's one side. I just wanted to put that in perspective there. On the other side, at the time that Diana was killed, I mean, firstly, I mean, Diana at that time was really not on my radar. I was aware of her, obviously. Everybody
how could
was.
How could you not be, yes?
Yeah, but, I mean, not in the sense of, you know, I wasn't a Diana fan or... anything of that nature. But I was, at the time, I was an editor of an X-File kind of magazine in Britain, a high street magazine, was doing quite well at the time because the X-Files itself was massive at that time back in the 90s. The whole UFO and cover-up scenario was huge, it was a huge kind of resurgence of interest in that whole area at that time. So. I was editing a magazine at the time called UFO Reality, but my main area of interest was the cover-up side of things, and my regular contribution, well, I did a lot, but my regular contribution each issue was John King's X-File document, which was basically investigating various areas of the alleged government cover-up on that side of things. And at that time as well, I know it sounds a bit odd now, but putting it back into context, at that time in the 90s, there was a lot of interest in what was going on. For, you know, the various intelligence agencies were showing a fairly healthy interest in, you know, the UFO phenomenon, even the crop circle phenomenon. You know, the CIA and British intelligence were wondering, you know, is it aliens or is it the Russians that have got some new technology going on here or something, you know?
Back to crop circles again. We had a program on that very recently.
But. Really? Okay. So anyway, coming to the point, through that those investigations as well, I got to know a few people who claimed to be working in various areas of the government, interested in various aspects of this whole phenomenon that seemed to be happening in those days. And to cut to the quick, I was made aware of some information. I'm not saying exactly where this information came from right now, but it was within this circle of people I've just explained.
Yes.
Of a high-level assassination was in the air.
You were told that there was going to be a very high-level assassination.
Yes, yeah.
And this is before the death of Diana.
Before the death of Diana,
How long before the death of Diana?
About a week.
And they said it was going to be, what, within a week or something like that?
Shortly, yeah. No definite time span was put on it. There was no name given, obviously. But there was, you know, I know it sounds, whatever it sounds like, but just, you know, I'm trying to put things in context of knowing the people that I happen to know through growing up with them, or the things they were involved in, you know, it's all documented, they're named in the book, not something I'm making these people up.
Well, haven't said who told you that information, though, have you?
No, the one person that I say told me that particular piece of information is named Stealth in the book, because that was his cover name. He was known as Stealth. I've written about him a lot in my other book as well, in Cosmic Top Secret. And in the magazine, was a regular kind of, or became quite a good source of information.
Now, I've read this book, and actually it is a really good book. I mean, it's fascinating from start to finish. And in it, you say that when he told you this, that he said to you that this death, this assassination, would be bigger than JFK.
Yeah, that's right, bigger than Kennedy.
And there aren't many, there? There aren't many that could potentially be bigger than JFK. In the event, I think probably it probably was, or as big as JFK.
Yeah, and in the cold light of day, it's easy, and with hindsight, you can look back and think, that was obvious then, wasn't it?
But you didn't work it out,
didn't put two and two together. But it's just putting things in context again, you know, as I say, if you'd have been in the pubs in those days, listening to the way these guys talked to each other about what they've been doing and what they're involved in, that kind of brag, that kind of boast was fairly natural, so when someone says this is going to be bigger than Kennedy, that was a quote, but
it wasn't likely to be true.
At the same time, I didn't take it
as I
didn't take it with a pinch of salt exactly, but I certainly didn't take it that seriously, knowing the kind of characters these guys are.
But once Diana's death occurred a week later, then I suppose in a sense you'd fallen down the rabbit hole, hadn't you? You couldn't ignore what you'd been told. Am I right in that?
Absolutely, yeah.
So where did that leave you? I mean, what did you do then?
Well, for the first little while, it was a very tricky time, to be honest. You know, I mean, the first thing I did, once that I'd realised that this really could be what this guy had been talking about, there was still no definite proof. I still can't prove that this is what the man was talking about, but it seems I won't ever believe otherwise personally.
Nice.
So I started looking at it. I started asking a few questions I mean, the whole world, it seemed at that time, was thinking, at the very least, there's something quite not right about this. You know, so many people thought that she died in extremely, suspicious circumstances, should we say, at least. So there was a lot of information was coming at us through the media and various other channels on the internet, I suppose, or just beginning on the internet. So it was a question of just beginning to look at what was happening and ask a few questions. I went to talk to a couple of people that I knew. everything that I've been told by stealth was kind of reiterated and confirmed by the other people I was talking to. And the more I looked into it, I was joined eventually by my associate editor at the time, John Beveridge, who helped me out with the investigation.
He's your co-author on this book as well, isn't he?
Researcher and co-author on the book, yeah. Who was a hardened skeptic to start with. He really, really thought this, I was wasting my time, it was an accident. He wasn't aware of what stealth had told me before, because I didn't tell anybody. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I started looking around, I started to ask some questions, and before long it started to look to me very much, regardless of what I'd been told, that there were a lot of questions that needed some serious answers, you know, surrounding Diana's death and the circumstances in which she died. And I just found myself being more and more drawn into it, and I contacted also my agent at the time, my literary agent, just thinking that, you know, I didn't know who else knew that I'd met this guy more than once, and I didn't know who else knew what he told me. I started to get, veering towards, you know, paranoid about this, because I didn't know who else knew that that we'd met. I didn't know who else knew, because of his claimed situation where he, you know, who he's working for. So I contacted my agent.
Do you know who he's working for?
He said he was a CIA.
CIA?
Asset, yeah. Okay. Yeah, former American Special Forces veteran. And so that's what I did. I'm kind of reliving it now, and I was just confused and concerned. And so because it's what I do, I'm a writer, so I thought the only thing I can really do now is look to perhaps writing something about this, and that very soon turned into, well, it has to be a book. I contacted my literary agent at the time, who was my former editor at Hodder & Stoughton, who did the other book. And we met up in London with John Beveridge as well, and yeah, he thought it was a good idea. We should do that. We should get it out there, because that might be a way of, you know, I don't know. It was just, it seemed that the thing to do, the natural thing to do. And, he had publishing houses crawling over him for the story. We had meetings with the managing directors, not the commissioning editors, you know, of there are various. Jonathan Cape was involved, Simon and Schuster were gagging for it. But within a few weeks, it was like, no, sorry, we can't do this book, we can't do this book, we can't do this book.
Well, it's interesting, because one of the questions, the first text I got, actually, Paul in Warrington, hello again, Paul, why did they block the publishing of the book in the UK if it wasn't a conspiracy?
Well, this is, yeah, exactly that. So we struggled and struggled to find anywhere to publish it. You know, I'm not Stephen King or whatever, but, you know.
But it was a strong story, and they were all bidding for it, and then suddenly.
Well, I was a published author, you know, with a reputable company, and I was editor of the magazine, and, you know, I wasn't unknown, is what I'm saying.
So but it wasn't about the quality of the writing, for
it
instance.
It was about a cover-up. I am absolutely convinced about that now. I was not so convinced then, although I was wondering what on earth was going on and why we were being wined and dined one minute, and then the next minute.
You were upset
and there's a
the
lot
door.
More, there are a lot more stories we might touch upon tonight in that same regard, how we were absolutely kind of gagged, silenced, and even when the book came over, the distribution was very difficult.
Very difficult. But it is available, isn't it, now, this Princess Diana, the evidence.
Yeah.
So, okay, having been told a week in advance, something obviously you can't prove, it's not a book, is it? So, you know, you obviously were doing research with your co-author, with John Beveridge. You know, let's line up the ducks. What did you discover that got you, you know, on this road to this book? You know, what were the things that I know you ever talked to other security intelligence people about methods that might have been used? I mean, do you want to talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, well, it might be good to kind of take a kind of chronological line, if you like.
Yeah, because, no, absolutely, let's do that.
One of the things, the first person I spoke to, I spoke to three people in particular after Diana's death that were, I didn't name them before, but I kind of identified in this, but one worked for the government, is all I can say. One was an MI5 officer serving, and the other worked for another military intelligence department of the government. I know that for a fact. Those three characters in the book have become a kind of composite, in a way, of information that's presented in the book in order to preserve their anonymity.
Okay.
But what I learned from those three sources, one in particular actually, but those three sources, I was introduced to one of them by another one anyway, so there's two effectively, was a kind of a timeline of what was going on in terms of motive for Diana's death leading up to the crash. This is why I'm so convinced that she was assassinated. John and I were told that effectively there are two sides to the whole kind of conspiracy on her life. There's the MI6 or British establishment side to things, which were much more to do with her, the way her behaviour within the royal family, her book, her Andrew Morton book, the way that she, you know, she became
a television interview.
Yeah, the Panorama interview. Yeah. When she became aware, I'm absolutely convinced of that as well, of the plot on her life.
Well, she did say, didn't she, in this note that she handed to Paul Burrell, I'm going to read it out, actually, she said, she wrote this in October 1996, she said, "This particular phase of my life, in my life, is the most dangerous. My husband is planning an accident in my car, brake failure and serious head injury, in order to make the path clear for him to marry."
Yeah, yeah, and we found another. There's another note, same sentiment, effectively, that was lodged with her lawyer, Lord Mishcon, in November '95, around about the time of the Panorama interview, saying exactly the same, effectively.
Wasn't there a video of her as well? I mean,
yeah,
the text here says there wasn't there a video of her saying there was going to be an attempt on her life that's disappeared. Is that?
Well, there's lots of things that disappeared. There are the letters as well that disappeared that were supposed to be put before the inquest that disappeared. They just disappeared. And they were communications and correspondences between Prince Philip and Princess Diana and other videotapes. There's a box, a specific chest that contained all this stuff that went missing, yeah. Yeah. So, So around that time, there was definitely, as far as I'm concerned, anyway, I mean, you can't prove these things, but we were certainly told that around 95...
I've got to just say,
yeah,
if you can hear anything, there is actually a rather large helicopter right over the studio right now making a lot of noise. Pure coincidence, I'm sure. Okay, carry on, John.
She did say she might die in a helicopter accident as well. So around this time, as we were told, there was because of Prince Charles' desire to marry Camilla Parker Bowles, and his ambition to do that, even though Diana was still alive, and that's the crucial point, that in itself caused a massive crisis constitutionally, so much so that I think in about 95. Tony Wright, who was the parlementary aide to Lord Irvine, who was then Lord Chancellor, publicly stated that Prince Charles' marital ambitions would end up in the church being disestablished. It was such a massive constitutional problem.
So the monarch would no longer be head of the Church
exactly,
of England.
Exactly.
And the Church of England would no longer be in Parliament, for instance.
Exactly.
We
would become a
Lords.
Secular state for the first time in British history.
Mm.
It was that massive at the time. And so there was some debate. There was some debate going on as to how to deal with this. Yeah, and with... MI5, it's not quite as black and white, but it's the easiest way to explain it. With MI5 thinking that Camilla Parker Bowles was really the problem here. You know, any thought of getting rid of Diana was too stupid. It was too big. The backlash would be too much. If, on the other hand, in order to solve this constitutional problem, Camilla Parker Bowles disappeared, then, given public opinion with regard to Camilla, especially at that time, it would be easier to achieve. MI6, on the other hand, who are much more the British establishment, wanted to get rid of Diana. That had been on the table for some time. We're talking November 95.
But MI5 wanted to get rid of Camilla Parker
Bowles. Camilla Parker Bowles, yeah.
And she was involved, wasn't she, in a road accident?
Yeah, this is all forgotten, you see, about 6 weeks prior to Diana's death. And this is another point we must talk about as well.
It is in the book. It is actually in the book.
But the whole road traffic accident scenario is a known assassination technique.
The Boston Brakes?
The Boston Brakes.
Well, let's talk about that quickly, shall we?
Okay.
And then we go back to Camilla and Boston Brakes.
Yeah, the Boston Brakes. I mean, Diana always said herself she believed that her bodyguard and former lover, Sergeant Barry Manicky, who died in a road traffic accident in 1987, was killed by MI5. She stated that publicly. She stated that on video. And it went out on the ABC news network in America.
In America.
And there are several other instances of assassination by road traffic accident. The most famous, I suppose, apart from Diana, must be Sir Ranulph Fiennes. Now, Sir Ranulph Fiennes, everybody knows, is the world-famous explorer.
Yes.
He's a former SAS officer. He's actually a personal friend of Prince Charles. He's a cousin to the royal family. You don't get sources much more eminent and credible, if you like, than that. Sir Ranulph Fiennes described in detail what the Boston Brakes assassination technique is, how it works, and effectively he recounted one episode when someone was assassinated in such a manner in England in 1986, a year before Barry Manicky died in his road traffic accident. And effectively, it's a small microchip that is planted on the car that takes over the car's steering and brakes, and the car is then taken over by remote control.
There must be some mechanical thing. You can't, because cars aren't steered electronically, are they?
By an onboard computer, yeah.
John, we're going to have to go for a break now. If you'd like to text in your questions or comments for John King, why not do so now to 8778 with the word EDGE, and then your text. See you very soon. Welcome back to On the Edge with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guest, John King. I apologise for having a few problems with our graphics tonight, but hey, we are live, so that's just how it is. John, just before the break, we were talking about the Boston Brakes, and I was saying to you that I don't understand how you could take over the steering of a car with the use of some electronic device, because there's mechanical connection between the steering wheel and the wheels in most cars.
Yeah, I'm no expert either on exactly how that works in terms of the actual mechanics of it, but I can only repeat what Sir Ranulph Fiennes describes in his book, and that is that the microchip transceiver takes over the EMS, the electronic management system of the car, and is then taken over by remote control, and the car can be steered by remote control. I know it all sounds a bit James Bond, Theo, but you know we can send rockets to the moon and Mars and wherever else by remote control. We can fly spy drones by remote control. You know, we can drive cars by remote control, and cars can be taken over, according to Sir Ranulph Fiennes, former SAS officer himself. And he cites an example of the Boston Brakes in action where a Major Michael Marmon, an SAS officer at the time, was assassinated by the Boston Brakes method in a car crash. The reason I was told in following up investigations and asking questions about the Boston Brakes amongst some of the SAS and guys I was talking about earlier, It's used because it's deniable, simply because it's deniable. If you shoot someone, they've been assassinated.
There's a hole in them, and it has to be explained,
Yeah, pretty well anyway. But, you know, if someone dies in a car crash, people say, well, you know, it was a car crash. People have accidents. And so it's very deniable, and it's proved, allegedly anyway, it's proved very successful for that reason.
I've got Gerard in London is saying, a drunk chauffeur in a powerful car seems more likely.
Well, that's what you're supposed to think, isn't it? That's exactly what you're supposed to think.
Is it impossible?
It's not impossible, no. It's not impossible. But Henri Paul, all the evidence, when you look at the proper evidence, suggests that Henri Paul was not drunk. The blood sample on which that verdict was based was never DNA tested or identified.
And it also had a ridiculously high level of carbon monoxide.
Yeah, the file from which it was taken was labelled unknown male. It wasn't Henri Paul's file. And it, yes, it contained 20.7% carbon monoxide poisoning. Now, if you or I had 20% carbon monoxide running around our blood right now,
we'd be unconscious.
We could certainly be unconscious, yeah. We'd certainly be extremely uncomfortable, especially if we had about 1.5 or 2 bottles of wine inside us as well, and prescription drugs. All of these...
So it seems like it might have been the blood of somebody who'd committed suicide, put a hose through the window of their
car. That makes sense, doesn't it?
It does seem to
be. That makes absolute sense, yeah.
I know also there's a film of Henri Paul on the night in the Ritz Hotel, doing his shoelace up, and he's doing his shoelace up standing up. He doesn't sit down.
No, and he's
talking
to guests.
Now, if you've had a drink, I imagine it's actually quite hard to tie your shoelace up standing up, isn't it?
He's acting perfectly normally, talking to guests quite comfortably, being congenial, walking around like a very sober person. He may have had a couple of drinks, but the evidence seems to suggest he did have a couple of Ricards at the Ritz. Maybe he did. Even if he was blind drunk, it still doesn't prove it was a drink-drive accident that killed Diana. No. But he wasn't blind drunk because there were 2 professionally trained VIP bodyguards with him, both, you know, former, Rhys Jones particularly, a former crack elite forces guy, and both of them testified that they were with him for 2 hours leading up to the drive from the Ritz to the Almar Tunnel, and they have stated categorically that he was not drunk, and they would not have let him drive the car had he been drunk. And all the forensic evidence as well supports that claim.
All right, let's go back to Camilla Parker Bowles for a moment. Uh-huh. Assuming that MI5 wanted to kill her, would Charles have been involved in this, Prince Charles?
Well, that is speculation that I really can't answer that. I mean, we all have our opinions, but I don't know. But what I do know is that Camilla Parker Bowles was involved in a near-fatal accident about 6 or 8 weeks prior to Diana's accident, and it was a very similar scenario. She was driving alone in her car, and she suddenly, mysteriously lost control. This is exactly what happened to Henri Paul. This is exactly what Sir Ranulph Fiennes says happened in the scenario he recounts. That also involved a character named Sir Peter Horsley, who was a former equerry to the Queen, an air marshal, very high-ranking officer. He says as well that he was driving his car, and at the moment, another car overtook him, and allegedly took over the steering of his car. He'd completely lost control of his car. Now, these are statements coming from the drivers of 2 people who have been involved in these scenarios and survived, but of course Henri Paul didn't survive to tell us a tale. But we do know he lost control, and the manner in which the car acted is precisely how the cars acted in the other scenarios as well. It didn't just crash into a pillar. Once he lost control of his car, his brakes failed. He couldn't use his brakes.
There were no skid marks or anything.
There were no skid marks. There would have been, obviously, if he'd have had brakes. His brakes failed, and he swerved one way, then the other way, and then back again into the concrete pillar. And that is very specific. There's a very, very specific manoeuvre, because that's exactly what happened to Sir Peter Horsley as well. And and in the case of Camilla Parker Bowles. So whatever we might think about the Camilla Parker Bowl scenario, MI5 being involved. I was told clearly and categorically that MI5 chose Camilla Parker Bowles as the one to get rid of, and that would solve the constitutional crisis. It would also frighten Diana to death and bring her back into line, because in their opinion she was out of line. It would, you know, kind of create a scenario where she would be then forced to toe the line through her own sort of fear for her own life.
Didn't Charles have another standby female?
Well, several probably, but certainly, yes, certainly. We know about Tiggy Leg Bork, don't we? The royal nanny, yeah. Whom Diana thought he wanted to marry at one point, yeah.
Okay.
And so, if that was the case, then who knows what was going on.
So, all right, well, let us assume for a moment, for the sake of this programme, that MI5 originally wanted to kill Camilla Parker Bowles. They made an attempt on her life, and that failed.
Mm.
But you're saying that other dark forces, MI6, CIA, wanted to get rid of Diana at any cost. You know, what was the motive? Because did they care about the royal family's predicament?
MI6,
or was there more?
Of course. MI6 is the royal intelligence agency, if you like. Yeah, they are. Yes, very much so. I mean, MI6, Prince Philip is very closely involved with MI6. Not in operations necessarily, but he's very involved. His personal friend for years and years, the Bilderberg founder, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, is a known MI6 agent. There's very much involved, whereas MI5 is more, you know, it is a more legitimate secret police agency, if you like. MI6 is...
Well, it kills people much more nicely and politely.
Yes, that's right. They're much more polite about it, yeah.
So,
well, they usually fail, don't they, so...
I don't know.
MI6 probably don't. Anyway, being more serious about it, what brought the CIA into the equation, as far as we've been able to discover, was unquestionably the landmine scenario.
Okay, let's talk about that then.
Well, landmines, people's reaction when you say that quite often is, you know, a few landmines, so you've got stealth bombers costing God knows how much. A
couple of billion dollars.
Et cetera. Yeah. A few landmines. Well, let me just put people right on that first of all. You know, there are 200 million landmines deployed around the world as we speak. There are 200 million more stockpiled and ready to be used. There are over a billion small munitions that are inserted into these insidious, cowardly weapons that explode and fly off all over the place. Which also brings into the equation airborne mines. It wasn't just landmines Diana was campaigning for. It was specifically at the time, but the treaty that she persuaded President Clinton to look at and back and support involved also...
Anti-personnel
landmines and airborne mines, which people...
Those
again,
are fragmentary bombs that break up into lots of different pieces,
and just as was used
in Gaza recently.
Exactly, like the phosphorus bombs and like the depleted uranium cluster bombs used in Iraq and probably Afghanistan as well. We're talking a multi-billion dollar industry. It's not just a few landmines.
And she did get Clinton to agree to ban them, and then I'm remembering this from your book,
that's
but
right.
He then, as soon as she had died, went back on his word.
That's right, yeah. She single-handedly persuaded President Clinton to effectively U-turn on US defense policy, and he upset an awful lot of people, you know, in the military-industrial complex in America and in the CIA, by taking a stand and agreeing to support publicly and officially sign the treaty, which was then going to be the Oslo Treaty, which would have banned the manufacture, sale and deployment of all mines worldwide. Yeah, 3 weeks after Diana died, Clinton gave a speech from the Oval Office saying he'd changed his mind. But what led to that, we were told, was that with Diana out of the way, he was able to do that. But stepping back a little bit prior to that, Diana persuaded him to support this, the whole landmine scene. But it's also what, what she was kind of highlighting in Angola. Angola, I know she went to Bosnia as well, but Angola was really the centre of her landmines campaign. And when Diana went to Angola, the world's media followed her.
Those famous images of her standing there with the plastic mask and the body armour and going through the...
She actually walked into a minefield,
Well, that's pretty... It is very brave of her, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And just down there behind that line of trees there was the Bush-Cheney oil syndicate and the CIA and MI6 mercenaries all sorting out who's going to win the spoils and divide up Angola's massive oil supply.
Because Angola is actually incredibly rich in minerals and oil, and yet the people who live there live on less than a dollar a day.
That's right.
Still.
Indeed, yeah, absolutely. There was an awful lot going on in Angola. As I say, that was the point of me kind of explaining a little bit at the beginning of the show about knowing the guys who was working out there as mercenaries, fighting on one side while the British government was supporting the other side. America with Bush and Dick Cheney's company, particularly Halliburton and Brown and Root, sorting out dodgy deals for the MPLA rebels out there on the promise of future oil on the cheap. All this came out after Diana's death, but it's official. It's officially there now. I'm not just shooting from the hip.
This is not conspiracy theory.
No, this is fact.
Established
Human Rights
history.
Watch, the NGO, published all these
all
facts.
All right, so let's say then that you've gone some way towards establishing a motive for the... Well, several motives for the assassination of Princess Diana. Let's look at what happened on the scene. I've got a text here from Simon in Devon, and he says, is it true that the security cameras... just so happened to be turned off that day at the scene of the accident. Is that true?
Well, what we've found out now, I mean, there was a lot of talk and a lot of questions, and so in the initial couple of years after Diana's accident, the French inquiry, which culminated, I think, in 1999, so that was a very immediate inquiry afterwards. But then, of course, we had Lord Stevens' investigation for 3 years, from 2004 to 2007, and the inquest. So a lot of information has been clarified over the years. So now we know for certain that there were at least 10 CCTV cameras on the route, plus one other on the flypast, like the
overhead
bridge, the
gantry.
Bridge looking back down onto the road going under the tunnel.
Yeah. Okay.
The 10 cameras lining the route, and this is official, this is actually in the inquest's report now, were turned inwards, filming the brickwork on which they were mounted.
Every single one of them?
Every one of them. All
well,
10 of them. And the one on the flypast wasn't working.
Surely.
So, therefore, allegedly, we have no video images of the journey or the crash. That's the official line. So,
although it could be that they were filming, and it's just that they don't want anyone to see the film, possibly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But... with the CCTV cameras, that's exactly... I mean, we know about 15 or 20 minutes before the crash, a woman was caught speeding going through the Almar Tunnel. But they don't have... certainly didn't have then. They may still not have. But in Paris in 97, there were no fixed speed cameras. It was all the mobile cameras. And one of the paparazzi who was interviewed by the French inquiry... who refused to be interviewed by the British inquiry. Of course, you can do that. You know, that's another advantage of assassinating someone on foreign soil, because when it comes to the investigation, any of the culprits or suspects can just say, well, I'm sorry, I don't really feel like being interviewed today. And they don't have to be. And so, we'll talk about that a bit later, if you like, how the inquest was just a complete whitewash. But one paparazzo, anyway, did come forward and say that he saw a police camera in the tunnel, or just at the entrance to the tunnel, just prior to the accident, and that must have been the one that filmed this woman who was speeding.
And she was convicted of speeding?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the things that happened then. There was a white Fiat Uno, wasn't there?
There was.
That was identified as having been in contact with the Mercedes that Diana was in.
Yeah, that's definite, yeah.
But the white Fiat Uno has never been found.
No.
And the reason that it was identified was because the paint was on the Mercedes.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
And it was identified chemically as a white Fiat Uno paint.
That's right.
And people had seen it as well. There were witnesses.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of weird stuff about the Uno, isn't there? Let's talk about Anderson, shall we?
James Anderson, yeah. James Anderson for a long time. The Uno was definitely involved in the crash. We know that. They've admitted that. Even the French have now admitted that it was definitely involved. So was a high-powered motorbike, and so was a second Mercedes. There were at least four vehicles, including Diana's, involved in a fatal crash in the middle of Paris, which involved the death of a British royal, and all, well, apart from Diana's Mercedes, the other three vehicles, all of them, and their owners or drivers, disappeared without trace. Now, you know, if that's not suspicious, then I don't know what is.
And wasn't there a motorbike blocking off one of the other routes that was originally intended to be taken?
That's another vehicle. I knew there was another one, yeah. That's right. So because Henri Paul had taken this other route, it's not such a strange route, actually. It was a route taken by a lot of the limousine drivers in Paris to avoid the traffic jam on the Champs-Élysées. So they did take this route sometimes. So
anything rather than going around the Arc de Triomphe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a nightmare, isn't it?
So, but he had to, then to get back to Dodi's department, just before the Aumar Tunnel, he had to take the slip road off, but he couldn't, because there was a motorbike parked broadside across that exit way. So he was forced to carry on. Then we know the white Fiat Uno dipped out in front of him, clipped the Uno, and then the rest is history, as they say. And the Uno driver, there were no tyre marks, remember, no skid marks, rather, not from the Uno or Diana's Mercedes. So that Uno driver had the presence of mind, having been hit, even if it was just glance, but he was hit by 4 tons of speeding metal that smashed into a concrete pillar and spun round in front of him, 2 seconds in front of him.
Yeah.
He had the presence of mind just to slow down gradually and drive on, but didn't brake. There were no brake marks.
Well, didn't brake hard.
He didn't brake at all.
But he didn't skid.
According to, he didn't brake.
Really?
We interviewed Professor Murray Mackay at Birmingham University, who is Britain's foremost crash expert.
Okay.
World renowned. The Uno didn't brake, even. There was no evidence to show that it even broke. It just braked. It just carried on.
So it was driven by somebody who was extremely
without question, yeah, in my opinion.
All right.
So, yes, I wanted to just say that because there was a lot of speculation that James Anderson, who did own a Fiat Uno, a white Fiat Uno that fitted that description.
And he was a paparazzo.
He was indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
And an MI6 agent. Was driving that Fiat Uno and that it was his. That never really sat that comfortably with me. I mean, if he was involved in such a high-profile assassination operation, I just couldn't see the sense that he would be driving his own car. It just didn't seem to fit. In any case, the evidence seemed to suggest that Anderson was very definitely a paid informant. But whether he was a hired assassin, that's a different thing altogether. And so we don't think now that James Anderson was driving that Fiat Uno. But the point is, the inquest has taken 2 or 3 almost red herrings, really. They've hung the whole story on these 3 points, you know. Was James Anderson driving that Fiat Uno? No? Well, MI6 weren't involved then, were they? You know. Was Diana pregnant? No? Well, then there's no motive for her death, is there? You know, they plucked these points out and blew them up out of proportion. The whole inquest was based in the end on Mohammed Al-Fayed's allegation that she was pregnant with Dodi's child, therefore...
And that they were engaged.
Yeah, yeah. But the inquest started with a remit that big. Lord Stephen's remit in the first instance was to investigate... I can't quote it exactly, so I'll paraphrase, but I'm pretty close. Investigate whether or not Diana and Dodi died by any other means than a simple road traffic accident. In other words, was foul play involved? It was an open-ended remit, and that was how it was worded. When we received when the report was published 3 years later and £4 million worth of British taxpayers' money later, suddenly the remit was that. It was an investigation into Mohammed Al-Fayed's claim. Allegation, I'm sorry, was the word. An allegation made by Mohammed Al-Fayed of conspiracy to murder. That was it. That was the sole That was what had happened. So anything outside of that, anything to do with landmines, for example, or anything that would have given them power to subpoena the paparazzi or whoever they wanted and really question people and find things out, was taken away completely. And now all the inquest had to do was prove that Mohammed Al-Fayed's allegation held no substance. And so that was what it was all hung on.
I think it's worth making the point that Mohammed Al-Fayed was clearly hugely distressed by the death of his son.
Of course.
And, you know, our sympathy obviously goes out to him, but it's also possible to say that he might not have been the best person to try and stir the waters to get a decision because of some of the things he himself said, which kind of muddied the waters a bit, don't you think?
Yeah, quite possibly, yeah. It was a very difficult scenario for him. I agree. I can't imagine what it would be like to lose a son in any circumstances. I don't really want to talk about Mohammed. We met, John and I met him a couple of times, and we didn't have anything to do with him in terms of his investigation. It was his and ours was ours. We did a book signing at Harrods when the first hardback edition came out.
He was there for your book signing, wasn't he?
Yeah, when it first came out. But that was the extent of it. I mean, I don't really want to talk too much about Mohammed Al-Fayed. I'm total sympathy for him. But in a way, yeah, it's a shame that he was up front saying some of the things he was saying and acting in the way he was acting, especially at the inquest.
Yes.
In my opinion.
So, in a sense, well, okay, perhaps we shouldn't talk about him, We won't. But let's go back to the Al-Matal. So we've got 10 or 11 cameras that weren't working. We've got a police speed trap camera that apparently was and wasn't there. We've got three other vehicles in the tunnel, plus another one blocking an exit ramp, that have all disappeared and never been found. Let's look at the accident. Let's look at just after the accident. You know, we've got about a minute to the break, so quickly, let's look at what was the scene when the accident had occurred.
Well, what we do know is before the ambulances arrived, James Anderson was almost certainly in the tunnel because he boasted to friends afterwards that he was in the tunnel and he took compromising photographs and he was about to publish them in a book.
And his place was broken into where the photographs were stolen.
That's right, just after he was murdered. Well, he was found in a burnt-out car 400 miles from where he was supposed to be with a hole in his temple, a bullet hole in his temple. But, of course, he committed suicide.
Yes,
That's the official
that
story.
Well, yes.
So, yeah, whatever went on in the tunnel there and then, James Anderson certainly knew because he photographed it.
John, we're going to go for another break now. Once again, if you'd like to text in your questions or comments, why not do so now? See you very soon. Welcome back to On the Edge with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guest, John King. John, just before the break there, we were talking about the scene in the Alma Tunnel after the crash. Do you want to carry on at that point?
Well, yeah, we were talking about, and James Anderson, we now know, certainly, that he was in the tunnel at that time, immediately after the crash, that he said that he witnessed the crash. He took photographs in the tunnel. As we were saying just before the break, we now know that those photographs were stored at the SEPA press agency, of whom he was working at the time in Paris. But that agency was broken into. His entire photographic archive was stolen, never to be seen again.
And no one else's was it? Just his?
Just his was targeted. And yes, James Anderson himself was a very interesting character, actually, if we had more time to talk about him, but certainly he was found dead in his burnt-out car. He'd set himself alight, allegedly. When he'd set out to Paris, towards Paris for a meeting...
With his publisher?
Yeah, that's right, indeed. Because he was planning to publish a book. We now know that, the photographs he'd taken. It was ended up 400 miles the other way in the south of France, with a bullet hole in his head. But of course, locked inside his own car.
And the keys weren't in there.
Keys weren't there, no.
That's quite a trick, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah, indeed, yeah. So, yeah, very suspicious circumstances surrounding James Anderson's death. And I mean, you know, we checked actually, interestingly, of the percentage of people who commit suicide that set themselves alight. And it's something less than 0.1 or something.
I think anyone I'm ever familiar with is that Buddhist monk.
Exactly. The only other ones we could find were religious or just cause type deaths, you know, like the monk you just mentioned.
The famous image, isn't it?
And the only other one we found was a French judge called Judge Borrell, who was working in former French colony in Central Africa, prosecuting a president there who was suspected of various, I think it was, I can't remember exactly what it was anyway, something involved like murder and conspiracies and things. But this judge, anyway, was also found dead in his own burnt-out car. And the connection there is that the same pathologist who pronounced that he had committed suicide was the same pathologist who autopsied Henri Paul, Professor Lecomte. That's just an interesting correlation there, really, because if Professor Lecomte's record is anything to go by in Henri Paul's autopsy, where she was completely incompetent, she didn't even know how many. One minute she took five vials of blood, then it was three. These are recorded details, and this is someone who's just kind of carrying out a very high profile autopsy here. Henri Paul's measurements were all wrong. His number was switched with Dodi Fayed. They didn't know who was who. You know the story. I mean,
yes.
Then all this carbon monoxide was found in his blood. This is the same. And anyway, at the end of the day, Henri Paul was found to be drunk, according to the same pathologist who said that Judge Borrell committed suicide in the same manner as James Anderson was supposed to have committed suicide, which you can make your own mind up about that, I reckon.
I think I probably already have.
Yeah.
OK, so we have witnesses as well. There are various witnesses in the tunnel, aren't there? People who've seen certain things, like the white car speeding away, the Mercedes, yeah, and the motorbike, high-powered motorbike, and so on.
That's right, yeah. Well, Gary Hunter, in particular, was quite a high-profile witness at the time. He was a London lawyer who was staying in Paris with his wife at the time, and the hotel didn't overlook the Almar Tunnel. It was the Almar Hotel, but it overlooked the road that was leading away from the Almar Tunnel. And yes, he was awoken by a loud bang that he assumed was a car crash. Two bangs, actually, two explosions, as he described them, in the tunnel. And by the time he got to the window to try and crane his neck round to see what it might have been, he saw what he described as a small Fiat Uno type car speeding away with another Mercedes car, bumper to bumper. He described them bumper to bumper. He actually said it was as if the Mercedes was shielding the smaller car.
Mm.
So that was an interesting. But yeah, there were seven eyewitnesses in the tunnel who described the Fiat Uno and the high-powered motorbike also involved in the crash.
Okay,
well, interesting.
And of course, Diana was alive after the crash, wasn't she? Because she spoke to various people.
She did, yeah.
And Rhys Jones, of course, was alive and still is.
Yeah.
Dodi Fayed was dead at the scene, and Henri Paul was dead at the scene.
Instantly.
Now, we're going to get to this subject. I've got texts about it. I've had loads of texts about it, so I'm going to read this one out. This is AJ in Cambridgeshire. What about the delays in getting Diana to hospital? Making sure she died at the scene. Well, I understand she didn't die at the scene, did she? So.
Well, again, there were a lot of questions to begin with, and we asked them all in our first book to do with the emergency operation. So many questions that remained unanswered.
How long did it take to get her to, what is it, Le Petit Salpêtrière Hospital?
Salpêtrière. Around 2 hours. I haven't got the figures in front of me at the moment, but about 2 hours, just over two, about 2 hours, 6 minutes.
This is ludicrous, isn't it?
It's 3.25 miles away. 3.25.
So over 2 hours to get
a
princess.
Yeah.
to a hospital, and it wasn't even the nearest hospital. No. They actually drove past another hospital with an accident room,
they
with
did.
A A&E
department. Yeah, they did, indeed.
So okay, why did it take so long? What were they doing?
Well, the official story now is that Diana... We interviewed... An interesting point. We interviewed a senior paramedic in this country. We do have to take into... I must be careful, because I do want to just say before I say anything else that the guys on the ground out there who came to the scene, they were in three ambulances, they were paramedics, and I have every respect for paramedics. It's an awesome job they do.
Uh-huh.
And they weren't secret agents dressed up as paramedics. They were paramedics. You know, the whole of Paris was there. Who was in the tunnel the initial couple of minutes after the accident? That's another question. But once the ambulances got there, they were paramedics and doctors on the scene.
Let me read this text out, because this might be informative. This is from Marie in Blackburn. She says, am I mistaken? I'm sure in the first reports of the accident, Diana walked into the ambulance, so I thought it wasn't too serious.
Well, this is what I'm saying. That, you know, when
did she walk into the ambulance?
Well, after the initial, in the melee that followed Diana's death, there were all kinds of reports, and some of it was true and some of it wasn't. And it seems now that no, she didn't walk into the ambulance. It seems that she had a heart attack through low blood pressure while she was still in the car, while they were trying to extricate her. Which then caused the doctor to think, well, we better get her into the ambulance and do whatever you do
heart
to someone.
Heart massage or something?
Yeah, whatever. But all of this then, it took about 45, 46 minutes to get her from the car into the ambulance before the ambulance even moved. Now, when I interviewed the paramedic officer who's quoted in the book, you know, he has total respect. France does have a different system. They have these SAMU ambulances, which are effectively operating theatres on wheels compared to ours. They don't necessarily rush their patients off to hospital. But except in a high impact collision, you have to assume that the victim might be bleeding internally. That is the golden rule. You have to assume...
Well, even in France, it's the golden rule.
Yes, you have to assume...
So does that mean the golden rule is also that you rush that person to hospital?
If you think that they could be, bleeding internally,
so why did it take them 2 hours to drive
well,
3.5 miles?
Exactly, you tell me. It took 46 minutes to get him into the ambulance, and then we now know that the doctor in charge instructed the ambulance driver, quote, drive slowly. And we know that the ambulance drove at about 8 miles an hour from the tunnel to the hospital. Now he says
it's
because
even 8 miles an hour, it's not going to take 2 hours, is it?
No, it didn't, because there was it took them 15 minutes to get there, then it took another X amount of time to get her out of the car, further time to the actual journey from the tunnel to the hospital was something like 25, 26 minutes or something.
But didn't it stop en route for 15 minutes?
Yes, once it got there, it stopped practically outside the hospital doors for another 10 minutes. And the doctor says that he thought that Diana may have been cardiac arresting again, but she wasn't, but he thought she may have been. So it took 10 minutes to... This is the official report. Again, we can only make assumptions, really, can't we? I'm not going to sit here and say the paramedics murdered Diana, because I don't think they did. I think the damage was done before the paramedics got there. Who may have been working in cahoots with who? Those are questions that still need to be answered.
Okay, well, I know there are people who think that she was killed in the ambulance. Do we know that the people who manned that ambulance that she was in on that night were regular ambulance crew, first of all? Do we know who they are? I mean, do you know their names, and have they been interviewed by people other than the police?
Yes, they have, and we have to say that now. That's what I'm saying. Like, before, we knew. Before Lord Stephen's investigation, we didn't know. They were just anonymous faces that were allegedly paramedics and doctors. But now, yes, they've all been identified and named, and they are regular paramedics. The point is, if this was from my point of view now, and from what I was told and what John and I discovered in our investigation, I am absolutely as convinced as I'll ever be that this was a Boston Breaks assassination. And you don't need paramedics to do anything. I think she was on her way. If she wasn't dead when they got there, but she was past saving. And the doctors have said that anyway. The doctor at the hospital said if you'd have picked Diana up and put her in a fighter jet and flew her there in 3 seconds, we still couldn't have saved her. Her aorta was ripped. She was on her way out.
There is something else, isn't there, that she wasn't wearing a seatbelt.
That's right, yeah.
And there's a good reason for that, isn't there?
There is indeed, yeah.
Do you want to tell us?
Yeah. Well, it was jammed. It was jammed. Quote, jammed in the retracted position, unquote. That is now official in the inquest report. And all the other seatbelts were working perfectly well, but Diana's seatbelt, the rear right seatbelt, she was sitting in the rear right seat.
Is that the place she would have automatically been?
I think so, yeah. Presumably. I mean, that's a good question.
Because that would put her behind the driver.
That's right.
Behind
the bodyguard, yeah, yeah. So only her seatbelt wasn't working, yeah.
Did the bodyguard, Rhys Jones, did he have his seatbelt on?
Conflicting reports. The French inquiry concludes that he did. The British inquiry concludes that he didn't. So.
And does he remember?
No, he doesn't remember anything. He did say, actually, he remembered being followed into the tunnel by a high-powered motorbike that was chasing them. But then after that, his memory's gone, he says. So,
okay,
that's what he said.
And was Dodi Fayed wearing a seatbelt?
No, none of them were. None of them were.
No.
No. But the point with Diana is, after the crash, all of her friends and family, everybody who knew her closely, was publicly stunned that she wasn't wearing a seatbelt simply because of her fears for her own life.
And she always wore a seatbelt.
Yeah,
apparently,
it had become
she?
Like a almost a religious observance of hers. You know, she'd become so paranoid or frightened that she.
Given that she thought she was going to die in a car accident.
Yeah. So she always wore a seatbelt.
So it would take very special circumstances for her to not wear a seatbelt.
Yeah, like it not working properly. I mean, she was, you know, they were travelling quite fast en route.
But there were early reports in all the papers, including on the BBC, that said that the speedo of the car was stuck at something like 120 miles an hour, or was it kilometres an hour, but a very high speed anyway.
120, that's right, yeah.
Miles an hour.
Yes.
And, but of course, it's an electronic speedo anyway, and it goes to zero.
It always reverts to zero, yeah.
So it was a lie.
It was a blatant lie, yeah, like a lot of the stuff coming out at that time. With the pictures of Henri Paul standing there with a drink in his hand on the front page saying, drunk driver. There was no proof of that. There was no evidence of that.
No.
You know, that was two, 3 days after the incident.
It was a nice, easy, you know... thing,
the media
had
been primed. They had been primed with what to put out. I'm absolutely kidding. It was all part of the cover up.
I've got a text in here from Simon in Devon who says, "Do you think there was anything ritualistic about the car hitting the 13th pillar, as this number is said to be important to secret societies?"
Well, possibly.
It's quite hard to organise which pillar you're going
well,
to
it is.
It is.
I mean, I personally. You know, I've heard that theory, I've heard people talk about that, I've seen articles written about it, but for me, the important thing is establishing whether or not she was assassinated. That's the point, really, for me, of writing the book, from what impelled me to write it. So, I tend to try and not get too involved in that side of things, the more ritualistic side, and I mean the secret society side, in terms of you know MI6 being involved in secret societies. Of course they are. You know, there are secret society Freemasonic lodges all over Europe, etc., where they can mingle and talk and plan operations quietly. That happens, you know. But in terms of the more esoteric side of things, then maybe not.
What do you think? I mean, do you think yourself that there was a Masonic connection?
Masonic in terms of what?
In terms of the people who might have had a motive or an opportunity or who were involved in some way?
Well, there are various levels of Masonic lodges and Masonic degrees, so certainly at the higher levels, possibly, yeah, possibly. I mean, there is a lot of very good evidence that high-ranking MI6 officers who are often stationed at consuls or embassies abroad also have their own stations and their own sort of substations within Masonic groups. Yeah, because it's common sense when you think about it, because the Masonic groups are sworn to secrecy, you know, so the conversations that take place will be in secret, which is what MI6...
They like that sort of thing.
They don't mind, yeah, keeping things secret. Yeah, but no, seriously, I mean, yes, Masonic lodges are without question used as kind of, you know... But not in terms of... it wasn't the Freemasons behind it, per se. You know, I know a lot of people who are just local kind of Freemasons who probably wouldn't have anything to do with this.
Okay. So, you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that your belief is that it was a Boston Breaks deliberate assassination.
Yeah.
But that the ambulances and all that story about the delays and all that was just coincidental, if you like.
Well, no, I'm not saying that either. What I am saying is that there are a lot of accusations flying around without any evidence, just suspicion and anomalies and questions.
Well, it does seem extraordinary, doesn't it, that the ambulance
took
2 hours to
get Diana
to hospital 3.5 miles away.
Yes,
I agree. And it wasn't even the nearest hospital with an A&E. I mean, why would they go to this Petit Salpêtrière hospital instead of the one that was down the road?
Well, it was about another 3/4 of a mile past it, so an ambulance travelling at a normal speed, that wouldn't have made any difference. But of course, when you're travelling at 8 miles an hour, it did make a difference. Mm. They say that the hospital they went to was better equipped. The surgeon was there. Well, the surgeon could have just driven down the road to the other hospital if necessary, of course. But yeah, I agree. There are still a lot of questions that remain unanswered and a lot of anomalies that remain unresolved.
There are other things that happened to Diana, obviously, in the hospital, and we'll get to those in a minute. Yeah. But I just wanted to ask you one question here, because I know you do know this. I don't know who sent this text. Do you know the Merc was stolen a month before the crash?
That's right, yeah, which leads back to what Sir Ranulph Fiennes was saying about this little microchip transceiver, because, yeah, the Merc was stolen, but the only thing that was stolen from the Mercedes while it was missing was this little EMS chip, the electronic management system chip, basically the onboard computer.
Yeah, but I don't understand this, because if I was going to do one of these assassinations using this chip, if I stole the Mercedes, I would put the chip in and they would never know that it had been changed. Why would they take the chip out and then give the car back, if you like, minus the chip, so then you have to go, oh, dear,
we don't know who repaired the car, either. The car was also left unattended for about 3 hours prior to it being driven round to the Ritz. It was the only available car on the night. But that was the car. There was no question about that was the car that was going to be used.
That was the one with the chip business, with the seatbelt that didn't...
Seatbelt that didn't
unroll.
Work. The replaced EMS chip, the unattended car parked in the Vendôme underground car park, again, no security cameras watching it, for 3 hours prior to it being used for that journey. So, yeah, the thing is, Theo, I can't sit here, and nobody can sit here and say, this is what happened and here's the smoking gun evidence, I know all the answers to all the questions,
because
I don't.
But at least you've cleared up some of the things. Some things that I didn't know, and even things perhaps that might not have been in the book. Let me just go to another quick question here. John on Anglesey, another John spelled the same way as you, J-O-N. John, he says, have you done research into the technology behind the so-called flash gun used?
Yes, some, yeah.
Is that part of your thesis?
Quite possibly, yeah. One guy I spoke to... former SAS Sergeant Dave Cornish, who explained in quite detail about the strobe gun that was probably used alongside the taking out the brakes.
Yes,
he thought that quite in his experience, what would have happened would as the, we know that a high powered motorbike overtook the Mercedes just after the Fiat Uno had clipped it, so it was very precise manoeuvring whatever was going on there.
Yeah, quite, yes.
And it sounds
like a crowded tunnel.
Yes, exactly. It's only a two-lane tunnel.
Yeah. Well, two lanes either side, you mean, don't you?
Going it down into the...
Yeah.
Into the...
Two lanes either direction.
Yes, like a dual
carriageway.
Yeah. So he said that, the Fiat Uno would have been weighed down with concrete blocks or something of that nature to weigh it down and be custom weighted, is what he said. The person inside there would have had the remote control for steering for the Mercedes, and the guy coming past on the motorbike would have had the flash gun, which would have blinded. I mean, these things can blind you for up to 3 minutes, literally blackout. You can't see anything. They're so powerful; they can cause like
retinal damage.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you were driving a car, and especially when you're in a tunnel which is fairly dark, I mean, obviously I know there were lights, but it's fairly dark, so your eyes would be receptive to light.
Yeah.
You know, the pupils would be open.
And so there are several witnesses who saw a flash.
But wouldn't that same flash have affected the guy on the motorbike and the guy in the Fiat?
No, because it's a weapon. It's not just a tested weapon that Richard Tomlinson, an MI6 officer, explained all about as well in his affidavit to the French inquiry. It's a directional weapon.
Really? He gave evidence to the French inquiry about this? But they dismissed it, presumably?
They dismissed that evidence and they got to him before the inquest as well.
Well, he didn't speak at the inquest.
He did speak at the inquest, but everything he'd said up to that point, he completely U-turned. But just prior to him being interviewed, his house was broken into by French intelligence, his computers were stolen, his credit cards were stolen, his personal planner was stolen, his passports, he has two because he's dual nationality, British and New Zealand. And whatever else happened to him, I don't know, but after that, suddenly, his story changed. Massive story. I mean, this is a guy who's identified MI6 files to the French inquiry, identifying Henri Paul as an MI6 agent. Not have a look around and see what you can find. These files, these numbers I'm giving you, they will show you that Henri Paul, who works at the Ritz Hotel here, he's an MI6 asset. Go and check it out.
And he had a wad of cash on him, didn't he? His body...
Henri Paul?
Henri Paul had a wad of cash on him, and he disappeared for a couple of hours before.
He did indeed.
He drove the car.
Yeah, well, we now know, and this is official. Now, we've always said, I mean, the information I received was, without question, he was meeting up with his MI6 handler in that time. But we do know, official now, that he did meet with his French intelligence handler during those 2 hours. That's in the French report. He was found with his diary, had his contact number at French intelligence written in it. So he was definitely working for French intelligence. Our information is he's working for MI6 as well. Richard Tomlinson said exactly the same, and he identified MI6 files, which would have identified Henri Paul as an MI6 agent. And yes, he did have a wad of cash on him after...
Was it about £2,000?
About that, yeah.
And he also had a lot of money in his bank account, which wasn't explained by his wages.
No, he had about £170,000 in 15 separate accounts.
So just briefly, was he a patsy?
Yes.
He was
without question, yes. Definitely a patsy. He didn't know he was driving to his death, I'm sure.
OK, we're going to go for another break now. Once again, if you'd like to text in your questions or comments to John King, please do so now. Just text 87778 with the word EDGE and then your text. And I'll see you soon. Welcome back to On the Edge with me, Theo Chalmers, and my special guest, John King, author of Princess Diana, The Evidence. And also, I'm going to tell you his website now before I forget, which is www.consciousape.com. Conscious Ape. I'm going to read a few texts out quickly. Why blind the driver with a flash gun when there was a microchip driving the car? That's Greg in Bristol.
Maybe they didn't. I'm just saying that these are reports. There were certainly witness reports of a blinding flash. And it was Richard Tomlinson who brought that up. The strobe gun is a known special forces weapon to blind someone in those kind of instances. So maybe they did, maybe they didn't.
Okay. Do you think Henry Paul was subjected to mind control techniques so that he could be triggered into crashing the car? Simon in Devon, that's a good question, isn't it?
Who knows? Quite possibly, yeah. Quite possibly.
Okay, this is a guy, Mad Max in Derby. Apparently one French witness saw the bike and flash... And one guy got off the bike and made cutthroat gesture with his finger to show she was dead. Is this, and then he's cut off, so I don't know.
That's right, yeah, that was, I think that was François Leviste who saw that. He saw the flash in his wing mirror, in his rear view mirror, got out the car, looked back, and the guy on the motorbike who had driven past and was probably responsible for the flash, if there was one, yeah, did make a gesture, according to François Leviste.
Okay. If John's theory on the Boston brakes is correct, was the chip ever found in the crashed car? That's John.
Well, we don't know, because the crashed car was not investigated by anyone. It should have been investigated by the experts who were appointed to look at the wreckage were, you know, French secret secret agents and whoever they're working for, you know, specialised teams. The Mercedes engineers weren't allowed to look at the car. They weren't allowed to go anywhere near the car.
Right. OK, this is a really good text here. The strobe weapon is known as a sunblaster, used against vehicles and aircraft. As about the explosive half cap. As about, I don't quite understand that. Also used to disable moving vehicles. Cheers, ex-special forces.
There we are.
There you are. So, a few people. God, they're coming in thick and fast now. Chrissy in Ashford, I've always known she was disposed of because she was treading on the toes of the establishment. Thank you for your work.
Yeah,
that's obviously
you.
For you, Chrissy, from Chrissy in Ashford. Okay, a chap called Tino, it's scrolled off the screen now. Oh, no, do you believe Diana was pregnant? Thanks, Tino. We are going to get to that question. So, was she pregnant?
Well, we'll never know. But I just before we go into that, I just want to say I was talking a bit earlier about these nuggets of things that they hung the inquest on. Was she pregnant? The inquest effectively proved officially that she wasn't. Therefore, there was no motive for her death. But the point is, it doesn't matter whether she was pregnant. She was very definitely in what appeared to be the beginning of a long-term relationship with Dodi Fayed.
It was very near the start of the relationship, and she hadn't really got over that Hasnat Khan guy, had she?
No, but surgeon. even so,
apparently.
The fear wasn't, was she pregnant? It was, my God, she could get pregnant at any moment. She could get pregnant at any time. If she was with Dodi Fayed for any period of time, she could have got pregnant at any time. So the fear's not, you know, the motive isn't, was Diana pregnant? But the motive is there very loud and clear. She could have become pregnant at any time if she wasn't pregnant already.
Yes, so, well, that's true.
That's really the point. But going back to the pregnancy, we did, you know, we didn't really look into it too much in our first book, but we received some information from someone who wanted to remain anonymous. It's not another, you know, one of those. I have got a name for you in a moment, but the initial information that pushed us towards this was wanted to remain anonymous. And they said that he was a medical student, and his tutor, Dr. somebody or other, told him that his friend, who turned out to be, we discovered, Roderick Lane, a naturopath and Harley Street specialist, turned out it was Diana. He was Diana's, well known, in fact, for becoming Diana's nutritional guru. Diana visited Roderick Lane just prior to her final holiday with Dodi Fayed, because she feared she might be or she might become pregnant, and she wanted nutritional advice from Roderick Lane.
She didn't want birth control.
No. He was a naturopath, and he was a nutritional guru. So, but she wanted advice that if she was pregnant, she feared she might be pregnant. I don't know what was going on, or, you know, in terms of her periods or whatever, but she feared she was pregnant. So she went. This is what the information we received. So she went to see this character we'd never heard of. We did, in fact, in the end, track him down. And we phoned him up and interviewed him. And he was very cagey, naturally, I suppose, because we also discovered that after Diana's visit, his office in Harley Street was broken into and his computer equipment was stolen, never to be seen again.
It's incredible how many break-ins there are, isn't it, around this?
Yeah, isn't it? Now, he denied that. So we followed up, I followed up by contacting someone I knew who is quite a well-known investigative journalist in this country, who's a friend of Roderick Lane's, and he let it slip. Because I said to him, well, you know, this business about the computer then being stolen. You know, his office was broken into, we know his computer was stolen, and the reply was, well, yes, but we don't think that was anything to do with Diana because we don't think she was killed anyway. So,
he corroborated the story.
Yeah, and it's all in the book there. As I said, we didn't really have the resources to follow this up because the doctor we needed to talk to had moved somewhere across Europe and et cetera, et cetera. So we put it in there. If Lord Stevens or Mohammed Al-Fayed or anyone else who's got the resources to do it wants to follow this story up, there it is, because, you know, it's not evidence, it's not smoking gun, but it's certainly information that he's looking at.
It's leaning towards that direction that she was pregnant. But as you say, it wouldn't have mattered whether she was pregnant or not. If they wanted to kill her because of landmines and because she was messing up the royal family for two reasons. I've got a question here. Dave in Bradford, was Diana pregnant with the child of Dodi or the Pakistani heart surgeon?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Either way, it would appear to have been Dodi's, or the fear was that it would have been Dodi's, regardless of whose it was.
Yeah, there's been another question or two about that with her, hasn't there?
Mm-hmm.
But we won't go there. So, she was embalmed.
She was, illegally.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, she was embalmed illegally. You're not allowed to embalm anyone in France without express permission of either the mayor of the city, the town, whatever.
What's it got to do with the mayor?
Well, you have to get their approval, or the chief of police, or an immediate subordinate if the chief of police isn't available. None of those people gave permission for Diana to be embalmed. In conjunction with that, you also have to have permission from someone who is authorised in terms of funerary arrangements, i.e. a close member of Prince Charles, for example.
But he was no longer a member of her family, was he, Prince Charles?
He was still...
He was the father of her children.
He was still apparently on the list of people that could have given authority to
him. But why?
I don't know.
Because she was divorced, therefore she was a free agent and no longer a member of his family.
Right, she was still the mother of his sons.
Well, that's true.
So, anyway, the point being that none of Diana's family, nor close relatives, nor close friends, nor anything to do with Diana, gave permission for her to be embalmed. We found out. And neither the mayor, nor the chief of police, nor any subordinate in the French judiciary or legislative system gave permission either. The order for Diana to be embalmed came expressly and specifically from a man called Keith Moss, who was the Consul General at the British Embassy at the time of Diana's death. In other words, you know, he was it.
He was a diplomat.
Yeah, the rumour was that it was actually Sir Michael Jay, who was actually the ambassador, who was one above Keith Moss. So whether it actually came from him originally, we don't know. But what we do know is Keith Moss, specifically in the room, gave the order to the French embalmer to embalm Diana. And he afterwards claimed that he'd made a mistake in translation. His French wasn't so good because...
Well, the Moss said this.
Yes, this is the Consul General in France, representing the British government in France.
Who couldn't speak French.
Couldn't speak French, yeah.
Or, well, they...
Well enough to explain, don't embalm her, just clean her up for people coming to see her.
So but she was embalmed.
She was embalmed completely.
And now, in order to embalm someone, you have to remove all their blood, don't you?
Whatever you do, she was embalmed.
Where did that go?
Exactly. Where did it go? Where did all her personal belongings and effects go? We know, for example, Paul Burrell was told by one of Diana's close friends. We've looked at those as well, some of Diana's closest friends and confidants in the book, and one of them ordered Paul Burrell on his return to burn all of Diana's belongings. So none of them survived. All the clothes she was wearing that night, this is crucial forensic evidence. They were burned. Paul Burrell burned them himself on the orders of this person.
Which person? This Moss person?
Sorry?
Who was the person who ordered Paul Burrell?
Yes, that's the name I can't remember, so you'll have to read the book, but it's in the book.
Okay.
It's definitely in the book.
I didn't mean to embarrass you then,
no,
John.
No, it's fine.
All right,
there are a lot of names to remember.
There was a briefcase, wasn't there, that was urgently taken from Paris to Balmoral, where the royal family was staying in the summer. And it was supposed to contain documents of some kind. Do you have any idea what was in that briefcase?
No, we don't.
That's and again, why would it be going to
Balmoral? Well, why indeed did it go to Balmoral?
And yeah, especially as Charles got on a plane that morning from Aberdeen Airport.
Yeah, with a team of embalmers with him.
He had a team of embalmers too, just in case the French
didn't get there first, yeah. So somebody wanted her embalmed.
I was actually at the airport that morning.
Were you really?
And I was actually at Balmoral on the day she died, funnily enough. Isn't that bizarre? Just outside. I wasn't invited in. It's nothing to do with me. But I was there, and I remember it very well. So let's talk about the ring. Dodi Fayed had bought a ring at a high-class jeweller called Alberto Riposi, so it says here on my notes. That was had a special name, didn't it, this ring?
Dis-moi-oui ring, yeah. Tell me yes ring. It's a tell me yes range of very exclusive range.
So if the name of the ring is
tell
a
me
plea
yes.
to tell me yes, I've got to ask this.
Yeah.
What's the question?
Yeah, exactly. Was she? You know, I mean, it seems to me that the ring was very definitely an engagement ring. Yes. Whether she would have accepted or not, who knows? But certainly the offer was there, wasn't it? The proposal was there. Tell me yes. It was a dim one.
And it was a very expensive ring, wasn't it?
About £200,000, I believe.
£200,000 in 1997.
A lot of money.
So serious jewellery.
Yeah. Very serious. Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, Diana said to journalists just a few days before, didn't she, when she was on the Jonicle down in Sardinia, that, you know, wait and see what I do next. What I do next will shock you, or words to that effect.
Yes.
And there's a lot of speculation then, you know. But, of course, once things turned rather sinister after her death, then, of course, she didn't mean that.
The Jonicle was the boat that Mohammed Al-Fayed bought simply because she was going to spend some time with him and his wife.
That's right, yeah.
In Saint-Tropez.
Yeah.
And this is before she met Dodi, wasn't it? Because he was sort of introduced
by his father.
Yeah.
And of course they also, en route from Le Bourget Airport, when they landed in Paris on that day, en route from the airport to the Ritz Hotel, they took a very definite detour to the
Windsor's
Villa
house.
To look over there what Dodi hoped probably would be their new home. Away from all the, you know, the spotlight of the media in Britain.
And this is the house that the abdicated king and his American divorcee bride had lived in exile, if you like.
That's right, yeah. So,
so it was getting a
parallels
bit...
Parallels there, really.
A lot of parallels there. So, do you believe that she was pregnant?
What I believe, Theo, is I try and see it as kind of irrelevant, because when I get into this mode, what I'm trying to do is establish that she was assassinated. Now, I don't think her being pregnant or not is necessarily a motive. I think the motive there is the fear that she could have been pregnant at any time. That's what I think. So
that was just
whether
another
she was
incentive,
pregnant or not,
was it?
You know. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, of course, the fact that she was embalmed meant that... you know, the formaldehyde that they
use destroy any evidence of pregnancy,
right, exactly.
And any of the hormones.
All the toxicological tests.
I'm going to read out a couple of texts here. This is from Jen. I believe she was murdered. Why does Diana's own family and sons want to side with the establishment? Surely they know and shouldn't approve. That's a good question, isn't it?
It is a good question, but it's an extremely powerful establishment. You know, a lot of her friends... I mean, how can I say this? A lady called Simone Simmons, who was one of Diana's close confidants, she said some things at the inquest that were out of place, and she's suffered since, is my information. I think that a lot of the people who, you know, they live in this world, this privileged world of... this establishment is a massively powerful, privileged place to be. And to stand up and actually challenge it from within, it's okay for someone like me, I suppose, who doesn't really belong to that, you know, world. But to challenge it from within would take a lot of courage. And I think that is a big reason why a lot of people haven't and don't want to believe. They don't want to believe that she was murdered, because it threatens their existence. It threatens their very privileged way of life.
Okay.
I think.
Paul in Warrington says 7-7, no footage. 9-11, no footage. Well, I'm not sure about that, Paul. Mm. Diana's death, no footage. Coincidence? Question mark. I don't know.
Well, there's quite a bit of footage on 9-1-1.
Yes. I don't think that's.
I think some of that 7-7 footage is a bit dodgy, but.
Yes, I see what you're coming, where you're coming from,
yeah.
Paul. Okay, so we've got 8 or so minutes to round up this very complex story. On the one hand, we've got the official version of events that the chauffeur was drunk. He had an accident running away from paparazzi at high speed in a tunnel, and Diana was not killed immediately but died shortly afterwards because of the damage caused by the high-speed collision to her heart. And then we've got lots and lots and lots of other evidence which suggests that's not the case. I mean, how strong do you think the other evidence is? If you were to sort of say, on the one hand, you know, let's use Occam's razor, the most likely explanation is the truth, isn't it, in most cases? The most likely, simplest explanation is the truth. Is it at all possible that the simplest explanation is the truth? And against that, you know, we've got all this other stuff, of which there's a huge amount now.
Yeah.
You know, all the break-ins, all the coincidences, all the people involved with MI6 and MI5 and so on and so on, and
yeah.
The evidence that we know about systems that are able to do these kind of things and so on, and the cars that disappeared and the money in his pocket and all that other stuff. You know, that's in the balance of probabilities.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I agree. I think the simplest explanation is the truth. But I think the truth is she was assassinated. I don't think the truth is that it was an accident. I think the truth is she was assassinated. The reason there are so many different kind of ideas around it all still is because the truth has been whitewashed over and it's been replaced deliberately, in my opinion, by a whole lot of crazy stuff mixed in with some more credible stuff, mixed in with some very credible stuff, and it's all kind of been put out there and branded conspiracy theory, a little bit wacko, isn't it? Don't take it too seriously, you know, especially if you want to, you know, remain an upstanding citizen in the community, etc., etc. That's the subliminal message going out all the time. If you really think Diana was murdered or whatever other conspiracy theory you might subscribe to, then, you know, there's something wrong with you, isn't there? And that is a very, very definite subliminal going out through the corporately controlled media that we have in this country, for the most part, the
establishment, except here on controversial TV,
media, yeah. And the establishment controlled media. You know, it very much is. It's very much put that message out, and it's very difficult for some people to challenge that. But I think, without complicating matters too much, if when you really, really, you know, I went through that for my sins. I went through Lord Stephen's report, Operation Paget report, which effectively became the coroner's report, with a tooth comb, more than once. And if people could be bothered to do that, I don't expect them to. I mean, it's a boring, laborious task in lots of ways, but you really do get to see just how that man presented the evidence and weighted it in favour of the accident theory, because the accident theory is all it is.
It's just only a theory. It's just as unproved as...
It absolutely is, yeah.
So you're saying
Don't forget the inquest. The inquest did find that Diana died an unlawful killing, but of course it wasn't like... It was a...
Could have been a drunk driver, it could have been...
Yeah, and okay. the paparazzi, yeah.
Let's get on to some other final subject here. This is a text from Carl from Reading. Has John received any threats or been warned off? Good luck, Carl from Reading.
I can't say I've received any specific physical threats, and I don't really want to get too paranoid about one or two things that happened that possibly, but certainly...
Like that helicopter, really.
Like that helicopter, yeah. Certainly about getting the book published, that was very strange. We've been gagged, is what's happened, Theo. We've been gagged. We've been silenced and there's so many stories to tell, but yes, the publication of the book was a problem. getting the book publicised when it came out. We had the Sunday Mirror chase John and I for months for our story. Mm. Months. They courted us, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, and eventually when the book came over, we said, OK, yes, it's going to be front page news. The story is going to shock the world. The Saturday night before it went out, it was pulled. And we got a phone call saying, sorry, guys, it was a DA notice.
This is the Ministry of Defence.
Yes, that's right, Ministry of Defence, yeah, saying that our book couldn't be published. I did an interview with James Whale on his radio show.
Let me just backtrack you a bit here. Why would the Ministry of Defence say your book could not be serialised?
Because it compromised because it compromised the identity of some MI6 and MI5 agents and MI6 and MI5 operations. That's what they said. And the same thing happened on the James Whale show, which I was just about to say. We were interviewed live on James Whale. James had to say, sorry, guys, because...
This is on the radio.
He had to curtail the interview, but he had to block out whole chunks of the book he wasn't allowed to refer to live on air. Now, we have also been on Good Morning and GMTV and all of that, and it's been fine. But they're very safe little programmes.
Well, you get 2 minutes, don't you?
Yeah, and you're not going to be allowed to say too much on those programmes.
So what clothes was Diana wearing?
Yeah. So all things like that, really. More. The magazine I was working on went down. The distributor pulled the plug within, I don't know, 3 or 4 months of the accident. Suddenly we were out of work for no apparent reason.
And it was selling well at that time, was it?
Doing very well, yeah. Doing very well. So, and the wholesaler in America on the hardback book suddenly crashed. And we lost, not that I'm worried about that particularly, but, well, we lost an awful lot of royalties because of that. That's what our publisher says anyway.
Royalties, that's an interesting word, isn't it?
Royalties,
in connection with
royalties.
This.
Well, we haven't made many, so... But, yeah, we're not particularly royal.
Okay. So, any other incidents that have happened?
Oh, my goodness. Well, too many to mention, really, but the one thing we did learn quite recently, I suppose, towards back end of preparing this paperback edition, was we were kind of whispered in our ear, and someone said, someone we know is very well placed, who gave us a lot of information in the first instance. Uh-huh. You know, we think you've been set up, is what they said. We think you've been set up. You've done very well. You've got this out. I think you've been more tenacious and dogged and determined than they expected you to be. But they think that we've been set up because we've got some good credible evidence out there. But because it all comes under the conspiracy theorist's brand, if you like, it's all up there, uploaded on the internet, next to some of what I consider to be the more crazy theories. I don't mean that in a demeaning way at all. I mean, people believe what they believe, and there may be some credibility.
Some of them, let's call them less likely theories.
Okay, less likely theories, yeah. But some of them are particularly crazy deliberately, and I know for sure that some of those...
Disinformation.
Yes, they are disinformation, exactly that, yeah.
You've got 5 seconds.
Well, that's it, really. I think Diana was assassinated by the Boston Brakes.
John, we're going to leave it on that. Thank you to everyone for watching our special 2-hour show and for those who texted, and thanks to my very special guest, John King. If you've enjoyed this show, please tell all your friends. Next week, we'll be back with yet another exciting show that might even change your life. Until then, remember, they're watching you, watching us, watching them. Cheerio.